Yeah, Wayne.
My name is George Monahan, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really glad to be here tonight. Some of you may know my friend Al over here. I don't know if you do or not, but my friend Al is my friend because he is my great-grand sponsor and has been for 40 years. And he sponsored my sponsor's sponsor. And so we have some history, and Al has been an important part of my history. Even though we lived in separate states for most of the time, and we've seen each other, we figure, about 12 times, we did spend quite a bit of time together for a while. And so we still talk on the phone and do what the people in AA do. I'm going to tell you I'm going to give you my family of origin, and then I'm going to tell you what alcohol did to me and what I did to alcohol. And I tried to get even, you know, and didn't work well. But and then I'm going to tell you what I did and how that happened and how my life is today. So my family of origin, I had a mother and a father, which I guess you have to say these days. And they were both drunks. And I had an older sister. She was the oldest in the family. She was 10 years older than me. She was an alcoholic. I had a brother that was 9 years older than me. He was an alcoholic. I have a brother who's 5 years older than me. He has no problem with alcohol. We don't know where he went wrong. So, you know, he would have a drink and a half. My brother and I hated him. And he's still with me today, and I love him to death. And I'm lucky to have him in my life. I grew up in a house where, with the alcoholism rampant, and being the youngest, I lived through the worst of my parents' drinking. And I don't have any resentments for them, never did. They gave me the freedom to do whatever the hell I wanted because nobody was watching. They forgot they had me, and I forgot I had them, and that worked well for me. And so I learned how to live in the streets. As my brother has said, we'd have been better off being brought up by wolves than the two people that brought us up, okay? If we didn't get a lot of home lessons, you know? But somehow, we all had decent manners and even a sense of right and wrong that I can't tell you where it came from. Nobody ever told me, I can tell you. So I'm going to sit down. I'm not going to stand up here for an hour. I'm too old now. And I will tell you that all I know is when I was 12 years old, I had to call the police on my father for the second time. My sister called him when I was 11, because I called her. I didn't know what to do. And when I was 12, I knew what to do, and I called him myself. And when they were taking him out in the second time, it didn't go well, and didn't go well for him, obviously. And I was just like, I knew it was alcohol, and I knew there was something wrong with those people, and this was never going to happen to me. And I was never going to be like them. That's all I knew. I knew that alcohol was wrecking this family. And so, growing up, living the life I lived, I was living in the streets, really. And so I was in a lot of trouble without taking a drink, okay? I was taken to court, a family court, when I was 15 years old, and they were trying to expel me from school. There was 11 of us, and they were trying to expel the 11 of us. They charged us with taking over the school by force, which is the most ridiculous thing. Even as an adult, I will tell you, it's ridiculous, but that's what he did. In the meantime, I ended up with a year's probation, and I figured this time I'm probably going to get yelled at because my father and mother were in court. I figured this time... And I walked out, and I was walking behind him, and my father said to my mother, I had to take a day off from work for this. And I'm like, boy, they really don't know what the hell I do. So this is good stuff. And so I was free to do what I wanted. But I, because of what I saw, I was afraid of alcohol. And so when other guys were drinking, I would do anything I could to dance around the fact that, yeah, oh, okay, I'll order a beer, but I'd never even take a sip of it. I figured I'm going to end up like my family. When I was 15, my friend had a bunch of us sleep over his house, and they broke out these bottles of Sneaky Pete, and there was no dancing around it. We were all sitting there, and so I drank. And I drank, and I drank like I was going to drink every time I drank. And I had an extremely humiliating experience at the end of the day, and I was thrown out of my friend's house by his mother at 4 o'clock in the morning. And it was very embarrassing. The whole thing was really bad, and I was sure, that's it, that's it. Then when I was 16, I was in a bar with a whole bunch of guys, same guys, and we had a whole thing with guns and everything, and to make a long story short, I ended up driving a guy's car off a pier into a pond, a brand new car, and I jumped at it. I opened the door and drove the car as quickly as I could to get off that pier, and then I just jumped out of the car, and I lived to tell about it. The only thing is, the next morning I was woke up to being punched in the back, and I'm like, what? It was my father, and I'm going, what are you doing? And he goes, what the hell did you do to my car? And I'm like, to your car? And I'm trying to think, no, I didn't do anything to your car. He goes, you didn't do anything to it. He said, I just got in and sat down in my suit. I'm soaking wet. That this whole seat is soaking wet. I forgot that I had gotten wet, and then I got in my father's car and drove it home. And it never dawned on me. So that's episode number two of my drinking. The third time, I got arrested for, we were having a bit of a brawl in the streets, and I got arrested, and there were 10 of us that were arrested, and we went to the town jail in a town called Valley Stream. It was a judge that we all knew. He knew all our families, and he goes, okay, you can call your parents, or you're going to spend the night in jail. So 9 out of 10 of us said, we'll spend the night in jail. And then the other guy said, well, if you're going to all stay, I'll stay too. And so we all said we would stay, and he kept us in the jail. He couldn't believe we were going to do that. Because I knew I'd just go home and make up a story, and I get away with it because nobody cared where I was, so it didn't matter. I wasn't worried about it, and a lot of the other guys felt the same way. That said to me, I got to do something here. And there were 4 of us that sat around a quick coffee table talking about how we were going nowhere in life. We had graduated from high school. I graduated when I was 17. I graduated last in my class. I only got out because my girlfriend went and cried to a teacher so that he would take me back in his class. Otherwise, I couldn't have graduated. The principal couldn't get him to do it. But another teacher suggested to me that I should have her do it because he was a sucker for girls, and he taught all boys, you know. This was automotive shop. There weren't any girls in the class. And you know. So anyway, and that's how I graduated, and I wasn't going anywhere in my life. But I knew that's not what I wanted. And so on my 18th birthday, I enlisted in the United States Air Force. And I didn't drink for 4 years at all. And I did my job. I got married when I was 19 to that girl. I went and cried. And then she started crying being married to me. But anyway, we got married, and we had 2 kids while I was in the service, and the third one right after I got out. So when I was 24, I had 3 kids. And I had gotten a job, so that's why we had the third kid. But when I came out of the service, I was 22. I served almost 5 years. I got extended because of the Berlin Wall for a year, and then they sent me to Alaska, and at the convenience of the government. That's what COG stands for. If you ever see that, run, because it's really not a good thing. And anyway, I did drink while I was up in Alaska. I said I didn't drink for my first 4 years, and that's the truth. But when I was in Alaska, even the commander up there said, boy, they stuck it to you, my man. And so he's and he was a good Irish guy, and he said, I want you to do some things for me, and if you do that, then you're on your own. You can do whatever you want. And so I knocked off what he wanted done for in about 4 months, and then I was free to do what I wanted. So I played cards. I did a lot of gambling. I did a lot of gambling as a kid. And when you're in the service, you gamble with a lot of people who never gambled before. And that's always a good thing when you're a gambler. So I was sending more money home than I was making in the Air Force, you know. And I started to drink, but I didn't drink until I was done playing cards. I never drank when I gambled. I knew that was not a good combination for me. And my drinking up there was like everything else. I got drunk all the time, and I went to bed and didn't bother anybody. I didn't have to get up at any specific time, so I had it kind of made, and I didn't have any trouble at all while I was up there. And when I got out, I came home, and I did not drink. I was back to drinking Kool-Aid, and if you remember that in this audience, that's what we drank, Kool-Aid. And we didn't have any money to drink anyway, so we drank Kool-Aid. And I got a job, and I got a job with a good company that seemed to have a proclivity to hire Irish guys that had served in the military. And so I met a whole bunch of guys. I went to a training class, and there was a whole bunch of guys just like me, kind of. Some of them were married, some of them weren't, but most of them were married, and married young like me, and this company knew what they were doing when they were doing this, because they could work you to death, and you needed the job, you know. And but they were a great company, and they were. It's one of the best things I did for myself. And I started to go out on Friday night with the guys from the office. Now, I didn't drink any other time during the week but Friday night. But you know, we always have to look back in AA, you know, because when we're in the middle of it, we don't recognize it, and I didn't recognize it, but I was the last guy to leave the bar every Friday night. And it wasn't a problem for my wife, it wasn't a problem for me, so it was okay. And drinking and driving was not even anything I ever heard of back then. Nobody ever talked about it. It was no big deal. It was nothing. Everybody drank and drove, and all the drinkers did fine. And I started my career, I started to move up. And when I finally became a manager of my own branch, it was only 3 years later, the branch that I was assigned to happened to be right next to a bar, which I thought it would be a good idea if I went there and ate lunch. It was there that I discovered the Manhattan, which became the drink of my lifetime. I started to drink Manhattans. I never drank beer again. I never drank anything. When I was drunk, I would then drink liqueurs, beers, yeah, and whatever. Basically, I drank Manhattans. And I was 25 years old then, and I fell in love. And so I started to go out Tuesday nights and Friday nights, and occasionally a Thursday, and occasionally, and Saturday and Sunday, I drank my Manhattans at home. And I drank them a lot, and I didn't see it coming at all. I didn't remember that little kid on the couch who was never going to do this. And what I did is I just loved to drink. And so, I was someone who always wanted to have fun. I still like to have fun. I'm the largest child in the room. But the thing is, I had a different personality when I drank that I was not aware of. And it started slowly and then came on quickly. And that is, when I drank, I would do anything. So anything anybody suggested, they used to say, let's, and I'd go, I'm in. Whatever it was, it didn't make any difference. And so when I was 29 years old and I was working for a bank, my first job with a bank, and they put me in a 2-year training program, and after 2 months, they made me the manager of their largest branch. And not because I'm good, but because the company I had worked for before trained me so well, it came out during that period. And I mean, I could do the job they were doing standing on my head because of where I worked before. And so I was 29 years old, the manager of this big branch, and I had the world, and I went out to dinner that night to have supper. Only I decided to go to, there was an Irish bar that was right down the block. I decided to go there. And I drank quite heavily, and to the point where the bartender said, George, you can't have another drink after this. And I was like, what are you talking about? I mean, the guy knew me, you know. And I remember the exchange. Of course, I don't remember much other than the exchange. And he said, "You're gonna kill yourself. You've had too many of these things, and you're gonna have alcohol poisoning. And I'm not gonna make another one. You're only here an hour." And I said, "Oh, okay, all right." So I was not happy with that decision, but I figured maybe he was right. I didn't know. And I left, and I went back to work. And I was in a total blackout. I got to read the things that I said to certain employees that today they would arrest you for. Today they would arrest you for. And I got to see what I said to three of the people who work for me, what I said to the woman who had the most money in the bank. I told her where she could put her money. And the assistant manager, I remember Rita was begging me to give her the keys and go home. She's, just give me the keys and go. Just give me the keys and go. And I was like, oh, man. I don't know if I'm finished with this thing. Well, of course, I left there that night and went home. And my friend was waiting for me at my house with his wife. They had come to visit us. And he was a... He hardly ever drank. Basically, he drank when he was with me, but I didn't realize that. You know, I thought he drank more than that, but he really just drank when he was with me. And so he was like, "Hey, Sam, I'm never going to catch up to you. Look at that, you're whacked." And I'm like, "Well, let's go out for a pack of cigarettes or something. Let's get out of here." And so we went out and. We went to a bar in another town, and that night I got in a fight with a guy in the bar, and I beat him up, and I made fun of him after I beat him up, and he was pretty mad at me. And I learned about a resentment. I didn't know he had a resentment until I came into AA, but this guy definitely had a resentment because what he did is I thought he left the bar, but he hid in the clothes closet. The coat was wintertime, and I had to get my top coat out of the closet, and I did. And it was a second story restaurant and bar, and the stairs were all cement, and they went all the way down to the bottom. And I got out on the top step while I was putting on my coat, and all of a sudden I saw my friend go, "Hey!" And he jumped, and the other one jumped me from behind, and both of them came down on top of me on the steps. I knocked Santa Claus over. I'm sorry, Santa. And I ended up, when I stood up, I couldn't move my right arm. So I figured I had a broken shoulder, and frankly, that's where all the pain was. And so the guy took off running into back into the bar, so I had to go get him, of course, and with my one arm. And I went in and I grabbed the bar stool because he locked the bathroom door, and I was trying to beat down the bathroom door when the manager finally talked me into putting the stool down and leaving the restaurant, which is what I did. My brother was coming... My alcoholic brother was coming up to drink with me Saturday night. He was coming from Pennsylvania, so obviously I couldn't go to the hospital with this. And even though my arm was paralyzed, and my wife was saying, "You are insane," and I was like, "I can't go. My Bob's coming." And so where did we go? We went to a piano bar. And I tell you this because I walked in, you know, I put my arm on the bar, and then they're playing the music, and I'm going like this. And the guy sitting next to me said, "What's the matter with your arm?" Now, I hated questions. I don't know about you guys, but I hated questions. And I was like, "What's the matter with my arm?" "Nothing. Why? What's the matter with you?" And he goes, "No, but I mean, you don't seem to be able to move it." And I was just wondering what was wrong. And I said, "Well, it's none of your business, okay? I'm here with my brother, and I'm going to go to the hospital tomorrow." And he goes, "You haven't even had that arm treated?" And I go, "What are you, you're writing a book? You know, stay out of my business." And so the night went on. And I went to the hospital on Sunday, and I had to have my four Manhattans because I knew if I went there and they put me in the hospital, I was just figuring they'd fix the broken shoulder and send me home, you know. And when I was walking down the hall with the guy with the x-rays, I said, "So what is it, a broken shoulder?" And he said, "No, sir, you have a broken neck." And I stopped dead, and, you know, and I go, "Well, should I be walking around here?" And he goes, "Sir, you've been walking around for 2 days. 10 more steps isn't going to do it." So they get me in the hospital. And make a long story short, they were going to put four screws in my head. But I had a friend that had a broken neck, and he had four screws in his head. And he took the weights that they put on those screws and threw them over his head because he couldn't take the pain anymore. So they weren't putting screws in my head. That's all I knew. So I extended my time in the hospital by making that decision, and they finally decided to do something else, and they put me in a different traction, which I was in traction for 17 days, and then I was in a halo for 3 months. And, of course, I couldn't go to work, and I had to call Monday and tell the people there that I had fallen down my steps on my way to church, by the way. I figured I'd throw that in case I needed the church, you know. And the fact is that they already had affidavits from four employees that I had talked to. And when I went up there to see if I could come back to work with the halo on, because I was staying drunk. All I did was stay drunk day in and day out, night in and night out, because there was nothing I could do. And everybody was feeling sorry for me and coming over with a bottle. And I felt sorry for me, so we did well together. And so that's what I did. I drank. And it was bad, and
then my wife said, "You got to do something. You're drinking too much. Why don't you see if they'll let you work with the Halo and do a different job or something?" So I went back to the bank, only to find out that they were demoting me to, like, they demoted me from being the branch manager to the collector in the mortgage department. And so I, of course, was highly insulted by this. And that's when the affidavits came out of the desk drawer. And the guy that had hired me was a very good man. And he said, "George, I don't want to tell you this, but you're lucky you have a job, period. You're lucky. We're not going to cut your pay. You're going to..." I said, "Jim, I'm not taking charity. I quit." He goes, "George, you got five kids. I know you can't quit." And I go, "I know, but I'm going to quit. I'm not going to work you." I love Alkies. Oh, God. So here I am. I quit. He was a very kind man. He said, "Do me a favor. Give me the letter of resignation, but don't put a date on it." Well, I said, "Okay, I don't care. I just want you to know I'm quitting." They paid me the whole time until I got another job. Mm-hmm. And thank God he lived long enough for me to make my amends to him. He's the guy that hired me and gave me a chance. And so anyway, and I got a job right away. And I got a job that is made for an alcoholic. And I'm telling you, within a year, I virtually never went to work again. And I was working for a bank and getting paid pretty good money, had a company car, and I was drunk all the time. I was drunk every day. And I took customers out. I took a customer out one time. When I brought him back to work, he collapsed in the vestibule. Now, he was an older guy, so I figured, he must have had a heart attack or something, you know. So I went in and I said, "You know, somebody better call an ambulance. Lou is in laying down." So the owner of the company, because I was his banker, it was a fairly good-sized company on Long Island, and he said, I want you to stay here until we find out what happened with Lou." And I said, "Okay, I didn't care. I couldn't drink, but I figured I'd better do that." And he came out of his office and said, "George, could you come in my office?" And I said, "Yeah." And I went into his office, and he turned around and he goes, "Do you know what's the matter with Lou?" I go, "No." He goes, "He's drunk! That's what it is! He's drunk! What'd you two people do?" I said, "We went to lunch. We had a few drinks. He collapsed in the vestibule. They said his blood alcohol is 0.39. I said, "Yo, he likes those martinis. I mean, you know, don't be looking at me here. I'm still standing, you know." And so these kind of events started to happen with regularity. I was always in trouble. The town of Bayshore is a town where my bank had a big branch, and so I was working in Bayshore that day, and I went to lunch in this Chinese restaurant that made the best Manhattans in Bayshore. And so I never came out again until the police escort came, and I had really done some ugly things, and I had hit a guy that was there with his family, and I started punching him and beating him up right in front of his family. And so the owner of the restaurant, who loved me but now didn't know what to do with me, so he called the police. In New York, if they come into, they will not come into a restaurant unless you're going to press charges. So he told him he would press charges. Then when they got me out, then he didn't want to press charges, and he was... They had a bad cop and a good cop thing going on, and the bad cop wanted me in jail forever, and the good cop was, "Stay over here, stay out of the way, let's see what happens," this and that. So we negotiated for the banker in that town a deal. I wouldn't have to go to jail if I was willing to be handcuffed to a parking meter until that guy got off duty at 11:30 at night. And then he would come. This is 7 o'clock at night. So for 4.5 hours, I sat on a curb, handcuffed to a parking meter with my suit on, you know? Quite a picture. That's what alcohol did to me. I would do anything when I went to lunch. I got promoted. By the way, I got promoted in that job. And I got promoted. And I called one of my friends and I said, we got to celebrate. And he goes, oh, you're not kidding. We got it. That was Friday afternoon. I got home Tuesday night. I will tell you, let me tell you what happened, okay, quick. My friend was the sales manager for the largest radio station on Long Island, WBAB. Yeah. Right, Kathy? You know that. You know, okay. We went into his office to get some phone numbers, and we decided it'd be a good idea if we went into the booth where the disc jockey was and put him on the floor and then tell the people what we thought they should be telling, which was laced with profanities. This guy works there. This is the people I would hang around with, okay? If they were crazier than me, then I really liked them. And so he, of course, lost his job. And I continued on. I didn't get home until Tuesday night. When I got home, my wife had already left me once. This time she left with everything. She took all the clothes. She moved. Now, I know she moved to her parents' house. She had no place else to go. Or my parents. They would have taken. They weren't too big on me either. And so she told me I had to go to the Long Island Council on Alcoholism if she was to have anything to do with this marriage. And so she called and made an appointment for me, and I went. I went into this office. Guy was dressed kind of like me, and we talked for a while, and they gave me that 10-question test, only I was smart enough to read the bottom first. You know, we know those things, you know. I don't know why they don't know that, but they put the thing on the bottom that says if you get more than 3 yeses, you're an alcoholic. That's a bad thing to have on there. So I had 2.5 yeses. And so I didn't qualify. And they thought I did. And so he tried to talk me into it. And then he said, look, I'm a banker. I can't go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a banker. He goes, well, I'm a Catholic priest. And I go, you're a priest? He did, where the hell's your uniform? You know, I was born and raised Catholic. He said, well, I don't wear that at work. He said, this is where I'm assigned now. And he said, I want you to talk to my boss. So he took me into his boss. His boss came into AA in 1937. He was sober 35 years. This was 1972. And he said, George, you need to be at a meeting tonight. He said, I'm going to my meeting tonight. I want to take you. I go, look, I got a brother. It's much worse than me. I got a brother living in the streets. My brother was became an engineer for RCA assigned to NASA. And he's now living in the Bowery. And so, not me. Get that guy. He's the guy that really needs this. He needs to go. I took him once. and he goes, you did? I said, yeah, I dropped him off at the meeting. I'll tell you how that happened. I was in a hospital. I was in the hospital 19 times in 12 years. That's how long I drank. I broke a lot of bones in fights. I broke a lot of bones in car accidents. And I also had bleeding ulcers 4 times. I had diverticulitis twice. I had a stomach resection, and it was all caused by alcohol. But my doctor kept telling me I have to stop drinking, and I said I will. I will someday. Not today, though. And I was in the hospital with a bleeding ulcer, and there was a black man in the room, and he came over to me, and he introduced, he said, "My name is Jimmy," and I said, "Hi, Jim, I'm George," and he said, "Boy, you look like you're in tough shape, buddy," and I said, "Yeah, if you've ever had these things, they hurt," and he said, "Yeah, they're tough, I know they are," he said, "Is there anything I can do for you?" And I said, "Yeah, if you could, get me a drink." Now, you know, I'd said this in a lot of hospitals. Nobody ever responded to it. This guy says, "All right, he said, "But, you know, you're in tough shape." He says, "I'll get you a drink tomorrow." And he says, "I'll have one with you." And I go, "Oh, this is a home run. This is a home run." Next day comes, "My drink, how we doing?" He goes, "Nah, you look, George, you're not good, you know." He says, "We'll have a drink tomorrow." I go, "Jimmy, I need a drink." He goes, "Yeah, I can see your hands are a little shaky." I said, "Yeah, I got to have a drink." And he goes, "We'll have a drink tomorrow." Next day, I get a phone call from my wife early in the morning that my brother has snuck back in my house and she wants me to tell him to get out. And so I said, put him on the phone, and I tell my brother that he's got to get out of my house or I'll have my other brother come and remove him and blah, 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 blah. And Jimmy hears all this and he goes, "Boy, it sounds like someone in your family has a problem with alcohol." And I said, "Oh, I got a brother that's just terrible." And he said, "Well, maybe I could help him." And I said, "Help him? What do you mean?" He said, "I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous." Now, I will tell you, in 1972, I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. Never. And I went, "What the hell is that?" And he gave me, "It's a fellowship of men and women who share their experience." And I'm like, "Whoa, this guy's a weirdo. That's all I know. This guy." And he said, "And I haven't had a drink in 7 years." And I said, "You haven't had a drink in 7 years?" And he said, "No." And I said, "I thought you were going to have a drink with me." And he goes, "Yeah, we're going to have a drink tomorrow." And I go, "Tomorrow again with the tomorrow. When is today going to come?" And he goes, "Today never comes for me. I don't have any drinks today. I have all my drinks tomorrow." I go, "Okay, put this guy in nut ward somewhere." And I don't like him so much anymore. All of a sudden, I don't like him so much. Then we're laying there and we're swapping drunk stories. And he goes, "Yeah, I did this, I did that. I drove a car through railroad gates, missed a train by inches. I had three people in the car, one of them sober, screaming. I told the guy to choke him and do something, it's too noisy there. And then I hit the gates. The wood made a mark right across the windshield, ingrained the paint right in the windshield, and the wood went up in the air and landed on a police car that was sitting there. Luckily, he was just sitting there because he didn't have enough time to get it up and go and to catch me, because I saw him and I said, "There's no hope now," and I hit that gas pedal. And I was a wreck. But what I did is I got to the bar that I started drinking in that night and knocked down three Manhattans, and I was all calmed down. That's why I had to drink. People didn't understand that. I needed to drink because then I was okay. And then it was funny. All of a sudden, that was a funny story to tell people, how I drove my car through railroad gates and just missed the train. And nobody ever laughed about that till they came to AA. And then people in AA found it a little humorous. But those are the things, you know, and there was... There was a higher power in my life that I refused to acknowledge at that time. I was an atheist when I came here, and I know today that God was doing for me what I could not do for myself. I went to step out of a car one time, and all of a sudden I had that sixth sense that we have, and I said, "I don't think there's any ground here." And I put my foot out, and I go, "There's no ground," and I'm hanging on, and so I climb into the back seat and I go to put my foot out in the back and there's ground there. So now I get out of the car. Now there's another guy that works for me that drives. I hope to God he found the program. He was as bad as me. And I get out of the car and I see we are hanging off what I learned from the owner of the place, an 80-foot cliff. That when we pulled into the place in the morning, we had pulled up to a railroad tie to park the car. And when he started to drive, it was black. We were on it. We were on a ski slope. We were in a ski area. And it was Great Gorge up in New Jersey, and became the Playboy Club. I actually won a golf tournament there years later sober. Anyway, he hit the gas pedal, and the car was hanging on the transmission over this cliff. I'm yelling at him, "You got to get out of the car." He wouldn't get out of the car. Would not get out of the car. Never got out of the car. No, he would not get out of the car. Another Irishman. And I hope Desi found AA. But anyway, luckily, I saw the owner who we were drinking with. There was just the three of us. He was leaving, and I ran and screamed, and he heard me, and he was able to open the place up so we could call a tow truck to get the car towed back off the railroad tie so we could drive home. Those are the type of events that happened to me when I drank. There were all kinds of things that happened. And it was, my life was constantly full of insanity. I got up every day to see, number one, if my car were there. My car was there. And probably, I'd say, on the average of twice a month, it wasn't. And I didn't know where it was. And my wife would have to take me and make the run of the 6 or 7 bars that I drank in to find my car. Because I would run off with another friend, and he would do the driving for the night. My two best friends were both arrested for drunk driving, and I never was, because they would never get in the car with me. So anytime we were going anywhere, they would drive. Anyway, the alcohol was getting really bad, and my wife was getting fed up. When I talked to the guys from the Long Island Council, I asked them, I said, can you tell anybody what we said here? And they said, no, it's completely confidential. I said, if my wife calls, she can't find out. No. So I left there, went to a bar, had 2 drinks, and then, because I had to study the nerves, and then I called her and told her that they told me what to do so I could control my drinking and I was going to be okay. And she bought that because she wanted to, and she came back home. And so I continued on, it was the same thing. I used to not come home at least 2 nights a week, and promises, and it wasn't working. And then my brother died at 43 from cirrhosis of the liver and malnutrition. And when he died, I got the phone call because I was the only one in the family talking to him. And I had taken him, that black guy, and we shared stories. And he said to me, I got to be friendly with him because we were swapping drunk stories, as drunks do. And he said that, do you know what, he said to me, do you know what, where an AA meeting is? I said, no. He said, well, call a number and they'll tell you and get your brother there. And then I did take my brother to one and I dropped him off. Goodbye, brother. And I left. And of course, he got home before I did. But my alcoholism got no better. And my last drunk, I will tell you that he sent me to my first AA meeting. I went to 5 meetings and I quit because there was no way this was going to work for me. And then I went back to drinking. And my last drunk, I talked my best friend into meeting me. He had given up on me and wasn't going to drink with me anymore, but I got him to come out for one, as long as I was going to have one drink, and I didn't have one drink, and I wouldn't leave when he left. And the next morning, he showed up. I was in my car, but I didn't have the keys. I didn't know that, of course. He said I had the house key and the cigarette lighter, and I was trying to start the car, and I was in the passenger seat. And then I started kicking a car, and that's when he woke me up. He said that he would
They were not. They took me to a diner, drank coffee, and then they both, him and his wife, told me that they didn't ever want to see me again unless I did something about my drinking. And that, for me, was my bottom. And so I came back to AA on November 1st, 1974. And I did not want this program. I walked into a smoke-filled room. I smoke. We got two people here who belong to the same group that I did, and it was a 7-foot ceiling. You could cut the smoke with a knife. It was, you couldn't breathe in there. I mean, I smoked and I didn't like it. It was so bad. And things were different in AA then. We went on 12-step calls. I mean, I believe that that's a big missing factor for the people who come in today, that you don't get to go on 12-step calls like we did. And we would go on them weekly, at least once a week, sometimes more often. And that was the kind of stuff that you walked away from there and you go, boy, I don't ever want to be there. We had all kinds of situations that we ran into, but we just didn't want to... you walked away from a 12-step call and you never had, you wouldn't think that a drink was a good idea. I came to believe, and I have worked very hard to stay sober. I had an unbelievable life because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that I was afraid of everything when I came here. I had tons of fear that I had no idea I had. And today I am fearless. It's not like, I really have no fear anymore. Whatever happens, if I fall over dead when I'm talking here, I've had an unbelievable life. The grace of God has shined on me. It keeps getting better. I used to think like old timers were like kings to me. They were. We had a guy, right, Adrian. Every meeting he would say, "What was it? Eternal vigilance is the price of sobriety." That's how he closed every time he spoke, and now I know what that means. I have a family of 5 children. 4 of them have this disease. My oldest son is sober 28 years, but he don't come to AA, probably because his father's in it. And my daughter had 23 years sober, but didn't go to meetings for 5 years, and she picked up and trashed her life, and she's been battling it for 11 years now. She's got almost 2 years again, but she's not going to meetings. My number 3 son has no problem with alcohol and is the rock in my family. And I have twins. My son is just signed on for 1.5 years in Connecticut State Prison for his 4th arrest for possession with intent to sell. Lucky it happened in Connecticut and not New York. He'd be doing life. And his sister has, she has a problem with alcohol. She has two DUIs and still drinks, but she's so far functional. So all I can do is pray for all of them. I go to Al-Anon, and I make my 2 meetings in AA minimum a week. That's what I was told to do when I got here. And that's what I do. I make 2 meetings a week. Things have changed over the years in AA. The lack of 12-step calls, all the reading that they do in meetings today. When I came in, the group recited the preamble together and the meeting began. And if you wanted to know what was in how it works or the traditions, they told you to read the book. And they told you to read the book anyway. And so
There's been a lot of changes, some for the better and some for the worse. I will say that spirituality is discussed much more often and openly, especially here in Florida, and I'm very grateful for that because it is the strong part of this program. I've talked too long, and I apologize to the group. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, George. And this is now off. You can all say any damn thing you please.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you so much for sharing, George, for sharing.